Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, my wonderful audience. Wonderful, wonderful audience. I mean, during this time of enormous attacks on all of us who are standing up to the COVID-19 bullies, it's just wonderful to have this opportunity to keep talking to you. And today, you're seeing a familiar face, I hope, for some of you. He's been on my show a few times. He was just on Laura Ingraham a night or two ago. He's been on Laura Ingraham in the past. And his name is Peter A. McCullough, M.D. He's a cardiologist. He's a professor at Texas A&M in Dallas. He's published, well, I would estimate four times more papers than I have about. And I'm sure they're all require a higher level of intelligence on mine. They have to do with things that always scared me in medical school, complex chemical reactions and, dynamic reactions between kidney and heart. So this is a man who is brilliant. And he's never before tried to, I think, in any great degree to take on the world. But like a lot of people, COVID-19 and the abuse of patients, the failure to give them treatment, just induced Dr. McCullough to take on the world. Now you never know you're taking on the world when you get started. So I'm sure he gradually realized that, oh my God, this is the world. And I'm so proud that Dr. McCullough is one of the men who, one of the people who has written an introduction to my wife and my book, which is COVID-19 and the Global Predators. And the subtitle is We Are the Prey. And Zev Zelenko, whom you've seen on the show, also an amazing man who has written an introduction, and then Dr. Elizabeth Lee-Valee. And one thing I always like to mention is that Dr. McCullough has written two definitive research articles. I haven't mentioned this before, actually. I say I like to mention, I mentioned it in my book. He's written two definitive articles on the treatment of COVID-19, one in August of last year, one of December of last year. He's done more to put out the information than anybody else in the world in the scientific literature. And for this, he's taking a lot of abuse, which we won't get into today because it's not worth talking about. But he also is beloved by people all over the world. And he has written, helped write along with Dr. Valee, what I call the Blue Book, and it's just so important. It also should get mentioned at the start. And this work by Drs. McCullough and Valete and also another physician talks about early treatment and all the ways that a doctor can understand approaching early treatment. And on page 24, though that page could possibly change, there's how to get in touch with the frontline doctors who can treat you. And all of this is on the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons online.org. Did I get that right? I think that's what it is. I think I got that right finally. And basically find the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. So that's another great thing you've done. You've done everything you can to get people a proper treatment in this country. And as a result of you, one of my dearest family members is good and healthy because she and her boyfriend came down with a pretty heavy COVID. And unfortunately, they called us that night when they realized they were sick and they got positive tests. And she had a couple of things that could compromise her. And it wasn't a kid anymore. And they just went right to the line and got the proper medication. And the next day, they got the meds, I think in the morning. And then the day after, they said they were amazingly better. And I remembered you telling me that and Lee telling me that. And I always thought, oh, my God, these aren't people who exaggerate. Could that really be true? Well, now I've got my own firsthand experience. And let the devilish enemy yell, that's not possible, but it is possible. You give good treatments and medicine, people start feeling better or they get better. I mean, it's no shock, folks. It shouldn't be a big shock. We have so many things to talk about today that I don't know where to begin. I do want to mention that I'm not sure what hinterland Dr. McCullough lives in, but he has poor connectivity. I think he's in Dallas, Texas. So it's possible he may freeze and you'll see his handsome face, hopefully not with the worst expression on it, frozen for a little, or we may possibly lose his voice. But just hang in, because my sense, when I need to know the real, most informed, factual, scientific facts about anything to do with COVID-19, I go to Peter A. McCullough, MD. And you're just an honest, honorable physician and scientist and very, very intelligent. So, I mean, it's always good. And sometimes, folks, I've asked him something and he sent me an email. And then I say, can I put the email in the book? And he says, okay. So I really admire you tremendously. There's a lot of different things to talk about. I could start with we both got canceled along with 40 other physicians and healthcare people this past Friday, Saturday, and it would have been Sunday tomorrow, where Patrick Coffin, who is a mutual friend of ours, a wonderful man. He's a deeply religious Christian, a Catholic. He has put together top scientists and priests and all sorts of people. You can find, folks, I did a show with him to advertise his upcoming conference. And the conference is amazing. And the nice thing is you can still see it. So I want to advertise it on the show today, because this coming weekend, the show will go up again. But what happened is, the way the show works, it's really good. He's got about 41-hour interviews that you will see when he's back up. You'll see on his website. That's the basic part of the whole presentation. But then each person gets a half-hour live Q&A. Questions are asked, and then we get to answer them. We do a Q&A through Patrick Coffin. And I was due to go on. A few people got on early on Friday. I was very pleased to be doing 5:30. That's like a nice section to be on. And 20 minutes before I was to go on, the Australians, who are very much being overcome now by authoritarianism, more than we are, the Australian platform pulled the plug on him. Bingo. And before that, his website had been tampered with and none of my links went anywhere. So you couldn't find out where to find my book. So I'm going to tell you now where to find my book. And then we are going to talk some more. Perhaps Peter will have something, or Dr. McCullough will have something to say about the conference, because he is a participant too. There's a lot of good people at the conference. The way you get the book, folks, is you can go to my website, Bregan.com, but you can also go to a dedicated website, and it's www.wearethepray.com. Wearethepray.com. This is my wife's idea. if you misspell pray, you'll still get there. That was her idea too. And I'll tell you, I haven't told anybody yet other than a few friends. We've already sold, even though the book won't be out until July, 3,500 copies so far, even though it's not on Amazon, it's not anywhere other than on our spot and a few other places people have maybe put a link up. And one reason it's selling is it's the only book of its kind that just looks at everything from the role of the global predators in communist China to the American bureaucracy and to the individual issues, the vaccines and masks and the whole works. But I didn't think it was fair to wait until July, until you get this, the book. So what we do is we provide you, the minute you sign up for the book, in your mailbox, in your email, instantly, you get the latest manuscript. And so if you went and signed up today on wearethepray.com, within a minute or two or immediately, you should get the latest manuscript, which is only 2 days old. So we're really down near the end. So the book will have a few additional things in it. It'll be a book. It won't have as many errors in it. You'll see errors. In fact, you can send us copy editing errors. We love it. We give you an email you can send the copy editing to, because this has been such a fast, intense rush job. So let me be quiet now, because I want you to say a lot more than me today, a lot more than me today. So hi again.
Well, thanks so much for having me on the program, Dr. Bregan. I wanted to update the audience with respect to these really dramatic censorship events that have occurred. So this week alone, a program on the internet called A COVID-19 Tribunal Exposing Willful Misconduct was put together by Dr. Henry Ely out of Oregon. And they had in their materials indicated they invested 7,500 hours putting together this multi-day program. And they had approximately 2,000 people online. They had a tremendous infrastructure to put this on. My section alone, the first section of the meeting, included Joseph Mercola, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Sayer Lee, David Wolf, Dolores Cahill, Kimberly Foster, Kevin Jenkins, myself, Joy Fritz, Ronnie Cummings, Tara Thornton, James Lyons Weiler, Anna Garner, a famous attorney, and Henry Ely. And just at the beginning, we went over the science of the virus, and we had the very first expert give her presentation on basically fraud that is occurring with respect to death certificates in COVID-19. She had all the evidence. We barely got through her presentation and some commentary, and the entire program was brought to its knees. And there was no recovery. We tried to get it, and then it kind of sputtered, and then it was out. And all the audiences emailing, and we basically ended up recording it and trying to recover. Then Dr. Bregan, you're involved in the next big one, Patrick Coffin's meeting, again, well subscribed.
Up to 50,000 at the time.
People, the Great Reset too. Again, incredible leaders, Dr. Bregan, Rainer Fulmich, who is, he's a famous attorney from Germany. He's filing cases of crimes against humanity as we speak. I mean, just tremendous speakers, key religious leaders, sociologists, clinical economists, scientists. I mean, you can't get any better than
Zev Zelenko.
Yeah. And again, Dr. Bregan, I think, barely got into his presentation.
No, I didn't get into it.
And brought to its knees. So what we want the audience to understand is there are some people out there who absolutely positively are afraid of a message of us giving just fair discourse to a variety of issues with respect to COVID, its sociocultural impact, medical, legal, scientific ramifications. There are powerful stakeholders that do not want this message to get out. And they've been working at it for a while. I got a taste of this when I posted my very first scientific YouTube video on how to treat patients with COVID. It was just four slides from my original paper, and it was struck off of YouTube. And that's when the U.S. Senate got involved, and Senator Johnson and Lee and Cruz. And I subsequently had two subsequent attacks on YouTube when we attempted to reach out to the Australian audience. Somehow Australia fits into this giant spy novel that we're
the
weaving
communists
in front of us.
Are very, very powerful in Victoria. Yeah. You know, I had that wonderful Australian doctor on. You know him better than I do.
Eamon Matheson. Yeah,
yeah, and he's on our show. And he went up this week. And he said that in Victoria, they had the lowest, some of the lowest death rates in Australia. They're doing really, really well. And they got clobbered by the government for attempting to even discuss scientific papers that suggested early treatment. And so he wanted to point out what we got out of that was that it wasn't proportional to the degree of danger that they were, or degree of illness or anything that they were attacking on. It was simply wanting to stop the doctors. And then he had, I'd given a presentation to him a little bit or about my work and how I was tracking a lot of this back to communist China. And he said, well, you know, there's no place that's more powerful than Victoria, because that's a part of the, that route that the Chinese are developing around the world. They've got the northern land route and the southern water route to help them dominate the world. And Victoria has been is a important part of that. And there's the Chinese they've shown their strength down there. So I think a lot of it goes back to that.
Well, we got a taste of it. We tried to with Eamon Matheson, myself, Craig Kelly, who's a current parliament member who's been forced out of his party because he's advocated to treat COVID patients. So he's an independent there. We had prominent U.S. doctors. We attempted to reach out to the Australians on TV, and I'll never forget it. I was sitting in my office at the hospital. I had good internet, and right at the critical moment, our screens all went blue, that kind of really terrible looking blue. And then we tried to resurrect it on some other Q computers. We even went to our phones, and then our phones turned blue. How does the screen on your phone get hacked? And then finally, my landline got hacked in my office, and we did a post-mortem on this. We had two IT centers, one in Sydney and one in England. And we concluded that whoever was out there that hacked us down, they had powerful abilities. They knew exactly where we were. The hacking was masterful. They would not let a word get out to the Australian people. And it's so interesting because they've had relatively little COVID. It's an island. You know, it's pretty easy to socially isolate. They've had draconian lockdowns. When I published my first paper in the American Journal of Medicine, sure enough, one of the very first letters to the editor came from a Dr. Tony Corman from Monash University in Australia, absolutely saying that I could not treat patients. I definitely could not treat patients with oral medications. And it's so interesting. I've gotten letters to the editor that just said, Dr. McCullough, you can't do this. And my response is, yes, I can. And I'm doing it. And I even have better evidence now. And join me in helping treat patients and join me in overcoming therapeutic nihilism. So every time I've gotten vitriolic letters basically stating that I just can't do this. They're just flabbergasted that I have the audacity to treat a COVID patient. I've gotten them from Monash, Duke University, McGill University in Toronto, and I've gotten them out of Brazil. And it's so interesting. And the editor, Joe Alpert, is letting it go on in this ongoing dialogue of McCullough, you can't do this. Yes, I can. And here's even more data. It's the most interesting thing. Something is in the minds of doctors where they must be so incredibly frightened or disoriented at this point in time. They can't possibly even know which way is up. I mean, it really is extraordinary. Another little fact about Australia, everything you can find, you type it on the internet, you can find it. Australia actually tried to have its own vaccine, and their own vaccine that they tested on Australians backfired. And it turned the HIV tests of all the recipients positive. So now they're stuck with positive HIV tests. And so there's something about blocking early treatment and the vaccine, which is this horrible, diabolic, rolling ball of mess that we can't get away from. And somehow Australia plays a critical role. And, you know, in April, for instance, the most egregious thing, it was early in April in Queensland, they've put a formal law on the book that if a doctor tried to help a COVID patient by prescribing hydroxychloroquine, that doctor could be punished with up to 6 months in jail. And before COVID, obviously, any doctor could prescribe hydroxychloroquine for, you know, malaria prophylaxis or rheumatoid arthritis or... It's so interesting.
It's over the counter in a lot of countries.
Yeah. What could be in the minds of people to so sufficiently impair doctors' ability to respond? And it's not just hydroxychloroquine. Now it's ivermectin. We've had three cases in New York State where the families beg the doctors, please give my relative ivermectin in the hospital, because ivermectin can be used in the hospital and out of the hospital. It's got very, very good data. And they beg. And the doctors say, no, we will not. They call ethics consults, hospital administrators, no. There's been three examples where they've gone to a court, gotten a court order, and had a judge tell them, give the person ivermectin. It's like typically a senior who's struggling, and they give ivermectin, and three out of three, they revive, and they get better, and they go home. Now there's a case emerging in the last 2 days in Chicago, same situation. Family wants ivermectin. They went to a judge in Chicago. You can find this on Twitter. They even a copy of the court orders on Twitter right now. Family rushes the court order to the doctors and said, here, now you're ordered to do this. And they refuse. So they said, no. And now they're to the point, I don't know what you can do when you get a order to do something, or you have to go to some higher level.
Repeat your last sentence, Doctor.
I'm not sure what the next legal steps are when a court order is not obeyed, but the point I'm making is these doctors and administrators and others in these hospitals, they have everything to lose and nothing to gain. This is a medicine we use to treat scabies. So if a patient in the bed next door had a case of scabies, we could give them ivermectin, no problem. But a patient is there sitting there with COVID with her life on the line, and the doctors have their arms crossed and say, nothing doing, we're not going to give this medicine. So something is in the minds of doctors where you can imagine the family is now going to, they've already going to put together a letter of intent to sue for failure to treat. They've got, they can put patient safety hotlines. Risk management, you know, the patient's families can make these doctors and administrators miserable, absolutely miserable. And I'm sure you've had in your career difficult psychiatric cases where the family wants something. And in the end, there's always a little give and take. And maybe the patient does get a sedative or they get something, you know, as a, you know, we come to a middle ground on something. I've had in my career where patients really want a family member to get a certain medicine and we end up, you know, we kind of negotiate. We get to some common ground. Mm-hmm. Doctors are dug in and are complete. There's another case I just got called about within a few hours from now in Michigan, the same thing, patient fighting for her life. The administrators refuse to give any medication. They're very, honestly, in my opinion, they're very poorly treated in the hospital. So I've been a big advocate of early ambulatory treatment. That's been the message I got on Laura Ingraham. This week, I was able to get that point in. I'm getting very good media training from Dr. Bregan, who's helped me greatly. Whatever question I'm asked, I ignore the question and say what I want to say. So
Was that my early instructions to you?
I said, listen, we're making great advancements in early treatment. And then I got into the issues that she wanted to know about. For instance, you know, kids, do they have to wear masks and receive vaccination? Of course, my answer is no. That, you know, first principles are put what's in the interest of the patient first. Look at a four-year-old trial and ask the question, what's in that four-year-old trial's best interest? to wear, make their four-year-old wear a mask and get a vaccination? Of course not. COVID-19 is a self-limited illness in children. It's very mild. The natural immunity is robust, durable, and complete. And vaccination would have no role. Wearing masks would have no role. What we've seen in this pandemic is we've seen now stakeholders kind of march through different groups and do something to them, deny treatment, force vaccination. Now we have innocent. We've got little kids. They're not bothering anybody. And they're being menaced, in a sense, with a mask, with the threat of vaccination. And, you know, one of my thoughts was, is vaccination and wearing masks, is that in the best interest of the children, or is that in the interests of someone else? Is it serving the interests of someone else? And who are the stakeholders who are benefiting from this and why? And I think that's the question that Dr. Bregan and the audience are going to untangle over the next few months. But it's quite disturbing. Now, next week, I'm going on scene on studio with Tucker Carlson, and I'll see how much the producers will allow. I can tell you with Ingram, there's no discussion about vaccine safety. That's off the table. Yeah. So, and I tried. And we'll see how it goes with Tucker Carlson. We are at, so your audience knows, which is an atrocity, we're at 3,544 vaccine deaths, and we're at over 40,000 hospitalization, urgent care visits, and office visits in the United States. We have about double the numbers in Europe. So in total, we have 10,000 vaccine deaths, and estimates are, and I've talked with Stephen Malthouse, who's an expert on this from Canada, the estimates are only 1 to 10% of the deaths are even reported to the CDC, because a dead person can't report themselves. And as Dr. Bregan knows, physicians don't report things. And so I guess what I'm telling you is there is no doubt about it. We are looking at the most deadly product ever released on a human population. Yes. Ever. It's very, very important. People said, yes. Well, how many deaths would we have randomly? Well, I can tell you, we're at 100 million people vaccinated in the United States. We vaccinate 195 million every year with the flu vaccine. There's 20 to 30 deaths reported. Okay, just randomly, there'll be something. There is some ambient level. Maybe it's 20 or 30, maybe 50, but not 3,500. It's beyond.
Now, if that happened with the flu vaccine kind of situation, it'd be taken off the market.
Oh, instantly. Shingles vaccine, 3,500 deaths with a shingles vaccine. You know, keep in mind what's going on.
In fact,
on
it might
now.
Even come off with 20 deaths when they investigated them and made a good link, or 10 deaths.
Yeah.
Because if you're clearly killing people with a treatment, it's taken seriously, except in this new world we're in.
Well, there are deaths that occur right in the vaccination center. People are actually videoing these with their phone. It is plain as day. So when the CDC came out with a March 8th saying at that time 1,600 deaths, we've doubled that now, at 1,600 deaths, that not a single death was related to the vaccine.
That's like lying so badly.
That's malfeasance, because they stated that CDC and FDA doctors did this unnamed, right? The CDC, the FDA, the White House Task Force, Pfizer, Moderna, J&J, they're vaccine stakeholders. They have a stake in the vaccine. The National Institutes of Health co-owns the patent for the Moderna vaccine. What do you think these doctors who are all invested either monetarily or intellectually, maybe their careers are staked on this, when they review these deaths, they whitewashed them. I'm telling your audience right now, yes, they whitewashed absolutely. Them. It's a whitewash. And the families are outraged. The public is outraged. And the most interesting thing is, as we see more threats that occur. Now there's governor of Michigan says, oh, unless we have 75% of people vaccinated, we're not opening up. There are now 80 universities that are threatening the students and the parents that if the kids aren't vaccinated, they can't go back to college. Yesterday, Houston Methodist, which last week said if the workers don't take the vaccine, they'll be fired. Well, yesterday they fired somebody. And Now we're organizing with attorneys. Our only hope is with attorneys. So Anna Garner has come out of retirement in New Mexico. Attorneys are gathering in Houston. We have attorneys in Ohio and now one in Michigan and in Illinois. We will have to find people whose eyes are clear that can get a sense of what's going on. This is probably very similar to Nazi Germany, where initially people kind of got into this hubris of the Aryan race, and we're all together on this, and we can volunteer up our retarded children for eugenics. And all this was voluntary. All of the early rise of the Third Reich was voluntary. And then over time, it became involuntary. Well, here in the United States, this vaccine rolled out in December. It was completely voluntary in December, completely voluntary. Your audience will recognize that it's no longer voluntary. It is being coerced like you cannot imagine right now. This is beyond belief. This is Nazi Germany, but accelerated into 3 months. It's extraordinary what's going on. And so people now are fearing for their lives, that if they don't get the vaccine, they can't work, they can't go to school, they'll be impoverished. But if they get the vaccine, they could die. They know that the stakes are very high. So we're pushing hard. Dr. Hooman Norchasm gets a lot of credit. He was on Tucker Carlson 2 weeks ago. He's been working very close with our heroes and what our C19 group. He has pounded the FDA, the NIH, the Pfizer, Moderna, all the CEOs with letters demanding that they shut down the program, at least not to be vaccinating the college kids and COVID recovered. He has written every single college president, he and the board members. He filed safety concerns with CVS and Walgreens, and including the entry in their safety systems. He is pushing every button for them to reconsider this forced mass vaccination.
Who is this that you're talking about so wonderfully?
His name is Hooman Norchasm. You'll see him, and I'll spell this out for you later on, Dr. Bregan.
Well, spell it for us now, if you have it.
Yeah, it's H-O-O-M-A-N, and last name is N-O-O-R-C-H-S-L-M. He's an MD, PhD. Interesting gentleman. He is about my age. And I'm about nearly 60. He is a retired cardiac surgeon from Harvard whose wife had a tragic death after a product liability issue. And he had a product liability case that he won in her case. He has a book about it on Amazon. And he takes care of six children. So he doesn't have a practice anymore. And he must have time, because I have to tell you, and he's articulate, and he's been pounding these stakeholders for accountability. The great fear, and your audience should know this, and Dr. Norchasm and I, who I've spoken to at great length, completely agree on, if we mass vaccinate the college kids this fall, there will be deaths, and parents and the kids will be sacrificing some of them. Won't be many, but some will die. And those who die, those families, even though they can't sue Pfizer or Moderna or the vaccination center, they certainly can sue the entity that forced them into vaccination, which would be the university. And this coercion certainly it will be set up for a liability lawsuit. And these colleges, don't forget, have not had the kids on campus. They haven't had the expenses. They've collected tuition, full freight. Their pockets are flush. And I anticipate some of these liability suits will be $100 million or more for the kids who die with the vaccine. And it will happen. There's been too many deaths for it not to happen. So we will see how this goes out. I have desperate people reaching out to me all over. Dr. McCullough, how can I possibly get out of taking the vaccine? I've had high-ranking military officials say, we feel so uncomfortable vaccinating the young military recruits. It's immoral, it's unethical, it's illegal to force people into vaccination. And what I'm telling them, I said, first off, get a copy of the policy and get a copy of the exemptions. Can you believe in the hubris for mass vaccination? Some of these entities don't even have a policy. They don't even have exemptions. They are just going, catapulting forward and demanding. There's doctor's offices telling their patients, listen, you have to prove that you've been vaccinated before you even come in the office. And, you know, it just keeps going and going and going. Hospitals are announcing census. where they're going to make a census of those who are vaccinated and those who are not. And those who are not, then they're going to come up with coercive tactics to force them into vaccination. Keep in mind, this vaccination is it's investigational. It's not FDA approved. The CDC and National Institutes of Health say it's completely voluntary. So the government is loving this. The government's saying, hey, this is voluntary. It's not us forcing it. It's the employers, the travel agents.
Well, they're encouraging it. I actually saw the head of NIH on television talking about, well, we can't do it, but I mean, it's for the benefit of people. So if private entities want to make it required, that's a good thing. That kind of BS.
Well, it's one of two things could happen. There could be just a natural fizzle of this through two things. One is just having breakthrough cases. So the CDC is already up to 7,000 breakthrough cases. But interestingly, they're not the same as the reported cases. So right now, if somebody has a positive test result, COVID test result, that gets reported through an automatic system to Johns Hopkins. That's how it's reported, because that was President Trump did an executive order to make that happen. Then the community departments of public health, with varying degree of assiduousness, they contact individuals and say, well, did you get COVID? Is this legit? And so they're trying to figure out the breakthrough cases. I can tell you 70% of these phone calls are not even answered because people can't figure out robocalling, what have you. And so, and then on top of that, the CDC announced that there's a much more difficult laboratory bar to be reached for a breakthrough case to be diagnosed as a breakthrough case.
Explain so it's not what a breakthrough case is. People may not know.
Yeah, a breakthrough case is somebody who's fully vaccinated and it's been 2 weeks after their last vaccination who develops COVID-19. They develop all the cardinal signs and symptoms of COVID-19 and they test positive. But interestingly, they have picked a cycle threshold that would require many more viral particles than somebody with a de novo case. So the CDC has already announced
that. They're trying to hide breakthrough cases.
Right. So not only are they probably not going to call, or if they, you know, innocently people don't pick up. So unless somebody calls, they'll never figure out a breakthrough case. And on top of that, now they picked a higher laboratory threshold. I can tell you at 7,000 cases, I bet there's 70,000 cases. Maybe there's 200,000 cases. This is the tip of the iceberg. So what people need to know, it was 2 weeks ago, I had 10 patients in my practice with COVID. Six of them were fully vaccinated. What people need to know is that this whole thing could fizzle because the public will start to get an idea that the vaccine simply doesn't work. Okay. The other thing, which is quite interesting, is even though all the safety information is scrubbed, so the CDC is saying, hey, listen, we're not hiding the safety information. It's in the VAERS database. The public would have to have the sophistication to get into the database and to see all these deaths occurring. The social media is scrubbing it all. And through the Trusted News Initiative, which is an overt censoring program that was announced back on December 8th by BBC, CNN, Fox News, NBC, all vaccine safety information is off the table. It cannot be mentioned in the popular press because of the Trusted News Initiative. And the idea is that, well, if any safety information got discussed, it would worsen vaccine hesitancy. And even the doctor medical officer for YouTube said the same thing. Anything that ends up on YouTube that is judged to be showing safety information on the vaccine is going to be scrubbed. And so the public doesn't have a chance in finding out safety information except through their relatives and loved ones. And because there's been so many deaths and so many hospitalizations and so many injuries, the public is so interesting now, where they are quietly just not showing up to the vaccine centers. And the rate of vaccine centers now being visited by people is dropping off to nothing. I went past our vaccine center the other day in Dallas, empty. We have police officers there trying to direct traffic. There's no traffic. A big one down in Houston, Houston County, they just shut down. I'm telling you, the public may vote with their feet on this and say, listen, we've seen enough. It's not safe. We're at about 100 million people vaccinated. Many patients have got the first dose. They're not showing up for the second dose. The current recorded rate's 10%, and again, double or triple that. I can tell you the patients I see in practice, they're like, no way I want that second dose. I had a family member get vaccinated. She's like, no way she's going to get the second dose. And I can tell you one thing, 100% of people have asked me for a waiver to not get a booster. They said, I've been through this once. I'm not going for the booster. So I think the vaccine stakeholders are going to be disappointed with the success of the program.
Well, you know, their costs have been covered under the EUA, the emergency use authority. So I think they're going to be sorry they didn't make 100% of what they hoped, but they're making billions of dollars. All this information, almost everything you're hearing today is in the book, interestingly enough. And that's partly because I'm in close touch with Dr. McCullough and a few other docs. But Dr., it's all in there.
Can I give listeners a couple updates, scientific updates that I think are important? Some of them may have seen me on Laura Ingraham, and Laura tried to get me to bite on the trap of criticizing Fauci, of which I wouldn't do. In fact, I didn't mention Fauci's name. I simply said public health officials. I wouldn't even mention his name because I don't want to fall in that trap. But I did level some criticism on the CDC, which is fair. And I think it's going to be the type of criticism we can survive. And I said that the CDC is running about 6 to 9 months behind on applying scientific findings and principles to practice. So, for example, it was stated that children should wear masks. And the idea is, well, they could be spreading it to each other with asymptomatic spread. There's been two papers now, one by Cao, C-A-O, published in Nature Communications, and the other one by Madewell, published in JAMA, looking at this carefully. Previous papers just estimated that if someone was asymptomatic for 3 or 5 days before they had symptoms, based on models, that 40 to 50% of spread would be asymptomatic. But it was all based on models. Madewell and Cao actually directly looked at patients who are asymptomatic and tested them, tested all the family members, did case contacting. The Cao paper's importance from China, they did this in 10 million people. And both papers concluded that the percent of all spread of the virus is less than 1% in asymptomatic people. This is very important. Less than 1% of all spread is asymptomatic. Keep in mind that all the nasal testing done and the oral testing done for COVID is all FDA cleared just as a diagnostic aid in acutely sick patients. Those tests are not cleared for the purpose of doing asymptomatic testing. So it's very important. Asymptomatic spread is minimal. I got this point in on Laura Ingraham. And number two, very important, asymptomatic testing is not an FDA cleared application. So think about this, testing all the NBA players, testing all the NHL players, testing everybody getting on airplanes, testing on kids and this all this asymptomatic testing. I had a great interview and discussion with Dr. Jack Lyons Weiler, who's a PhD, brilliant individual, and he has the data. He estimates right now of the case count that goes into Johns Hopkins every day, which is 45 to 60,000, about 40% of that is basically false positive testing being generated off asymptomatic individuals. And it makes sense because your listeners would probably understand this, 45 to 60,000 cases a day. It should be just as bad as it was last fall, but it's not. The hospitals are basically cleared out. You know, we don't see ambulances running up and down the streets. The bottom line is we are padding the numbers with all this asymptomatic testing. And the sooner we can make it go away, the better, because all it does is just leading to this falsification of the numbers. It's one of the reasons why I think our programs this week were shut down, because the falsification of the numbers was going to be exposed. The other thing that's going to be exposed is the falsification of the death certificates. And there was an expert who's formerly worked in major offices that managed death certificates, and saying the current practice is that if patients are in the hospital and their COVID test positive, they literally get COVID as a cause of death in their death certificate as a form of a practice. In part, the hospitals are getting
extra money,
but I didn't realize this. But the families get extra money. So if someone dies of COVID-19, the families, the current policies, they get $9,000 to help cover funeral expenses from the federal government. So everything's aligned to rack up the COVID cases and deaths. I'm not saying that COVID's not a serious illness. I personally had it myself. We've had a death in my family due to COVID. Believe me, COVID is a serious illness, and it's real, and it kills patients. But the total numbers we're seeing are out of proportion. I mean, look at the United States right now. We're still the leading country with COVID-19, and with the leading number of deaths. We're only 1/6 of the world's population. So I wanted to get that important update down. This asymptomatic spread basically is de minimis. The other thing that's come out that's really clear is that COVID-recovered patients have no significant risk of recurrence. None. And so they can't give the virus. They can't receive the virus. And that tells you a bit about this vaccine passport idea, all this this green card, and all the things that people are talking about. The virus. How come COVID recovered patients aren't getting a gold passport? They're treated like second class citizens. You know, if you noticed at the Super Bowl, they let in 100 kind of timid vaccinated healthcare workers into an empty stadium, like that was a big charitable offering. And what I said in one of my programs, I said, why don't you fill up the stadium with COVID recovered patients? You know, show the world America's back. COVID recovered patients cannot give nor receive the virus. They can't. And in fact, in the whole world's literature, there's about 100 cases where doctors think, aha, I got 100 cases. I've looked at every one of them, and it's a misinterpretation on one episode or another of a nasal PCR. You know, the public cannot be fooled on this. If you saw a grandmother being hospitalized in the ICU over and over again with COVID, or if COVID kept sweeping through the nursing homes over and over again, you would have seen it by now. And I'm telling you right now, COVID does not keep attacking the same person over and over again. When someone gets the virus, they get natural immunity. In fact, the laboratory studies show they get a balance of antibodies against the spike protein, the nucleocapsid, as well as polymerases, the lipid envelope. There is robust T-cell immunity and innate immunity. And in fact, the studies, you're looking at T-cell immunity compared to the vaccine, the T-cell immunity is probably 50 to 100-fold greater than anything you see with the vaccine. Keep in mind, all the vaccines right now genetically are coded against the Wuhan wild-type virus, the original virus that came out of Wuhan. The Pfizer and Moderna just differ by one or two base pairs because the Pfizer tried to make their vaccine a little bit less what's called reactogenic or toxic to the body. But the bottom line is they genetically code to the Wuhan wild-type virus. In the United States today, less than 1% of all the cases are the Wuhan wild-type virus. Mm. United States, by CDC data towards the end of March, we had 14 different variants in the United States, 14 different mutant forms in the United States. The most common one is the United Kingdom variant currently. So the idea here is that these vaccines cause a really large spike in antibodies against the spike protein, way higher numbers, by the way, than the natural infection. And then they tail off, but they give relatively little cell-based immunity. Now, it looks like the vaccines do protect against common variants, so I don't think people have to worry about that. I'm sure a lot of the audience has taken the vaccine. It looks like it does protect against this, but what the audience should know is that vaccine creates a very narrow library of immunity against the spike protein. Nothing against the nucleocapsid, nothing against the polymerases, much less T-cell immunity. We don't know about innate immunity. And so the theory here is that we have 100 million people vaccinated. They are immunologic clones of one another. There is no heterogeneity from person to person. Right. The naturally recovered people have a lot of heterogeneity. In fact, my wife and I got sick at the same time. I've asked the lab, because we were in a research study, to send us the sequences. I want to find out if we had the same strain or different strains, because heterogeneity, the body biologically likes heterogeneity. It doesn't like monolithic things. but we have 100 million people who are immune clones of one another. The great concern, and there's been over, I think, 150 prominent scientists that have sent letters, a single letter to every world government saying shut down the vaccine program, because the fear is there will be a virulent mutant strain that will easily recognize that everybody has the same immunity, and it'll cause great harm either to those people or who they pass it on to. So we're following developments closely out of Maharashtra, India, the state that had vaccinated the most. Keep in mind, India was doing great in terms of managing COVID-19. They had early treatment until they started a mass vaccination program in some of their states. In the state that did the most mass vaccination, they had nearly 120 million people vaccinated in Maharashtra, which is almost the whole state. It was a wildfire of new cases. Now they're describing double mutants or others. We can't get a straight story out of it. If the vaccine provoked this flashpoint in India right now, but it's quite devastating. The virologists, Gert Van Den Bosch, Bruce Bridle, Michael Yaden, 150 on this letter, all think that mass vaccination in the middle of a pandemic is a bad idea, because there's too much ambient virus out there, and the vaccine can only give a limited immunity. Keep in mind, childhood vaccines, we vaccinate the child when they're well, but we don't have a ton of cases around, so we don't foster mutant strains. If we gave an entire population an antibiotic, for instance, we gave 100 million people the same antibiotic, I guarantee we'd have resistant strains of bacteria.
Yeah. A couple of things I wanted to mention. One is that, Dr. McCullough knows about this, in our recent research, Ginger and I, we found that the idea of vaccinating for COVID was developed in just prior to January 2017. And it appears that what happened is, first of all, one of the things that's clear is that COVID-19 coronaviruses were not considered by scientists likely to jump to humans or to other animals. They were one of the least likely to move species. So they weren't thinking of them as going to be the great dangers and the great risks. But it turns out they're the easiest to manipulate in a lab and to turn into virulent viruses. So the coronaviruses are the easiest to manipulate in the lab that we now have. So starting way back, maybe 2008 or so, 2006, heavy work began on making a virulent virus out of coronaviruses. And by 2015, they'd really accomplished this well, and they'd also done some earlier work. Well, between 2015 and 2017, the drug companies, often led by Bill Gates, began to set up platforms for the rapid development of coronavirus vaccines, 3 years ahead or more of the actual appearance of the vaccine. So that when Trump, Fauci on his over his left shoulder, came out and said, we now have this brand new thing, it's Operation Warp Speed, we all thought, and I thought until a month or two ago, well, this just evolved. Actually, I've now tracked it back. The entire Warp Speed concept without the name was full blown already with coronaviruses, already with the same drug companies involved doing RNA viruses in 2017. And we even have a publication, which almost everybody's missed, out of Johns Hopkins in 2017. I'm not talking about 2020. People have heard about some of this stuff in 2020. 2017, where they describe in a book, a futuristic book, how they're developing RNA viruses against a coronavirus. They call the vaccine Coronavirus. This is in 2017. So these folks are not backing down. They figured out where the money was. They started planning on this event 3 to 4 years ago and investing billions of dollars in it. All this is in in the book.
Dr. Brega, I'm looking at the Johns Hopkins 89-page publication by the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security in October of 2017.
That's it.
And the title of this, so your audience can hear this, it's called The SPARS Pandemic.
Yes.
SPARS.
They weren't hiding anything.
SPARS Pandemic. It says SPARS pandemic 2025 to 2028. That's when they thought that this would hit. A futuristic scenario for public health communication. To read this document.
You lost your last sentence. Idea, repeat your
last sentence. It's absolutely chilling to read this document on the chapters. Chapter one, the SPARS outbreak begins. Chapter two, a possible cure. Chapter three, a potential vaccine. Chapter three, the vaccine. And then it just keeps going and going and going.
And that dovetails back to 2010 when the Rockefeller Foundation, without mentioning a SARS virus or a SARS-CoV virus, talked about lockstep, how they were going to have to shut down the world with the next virus. They have been building, the authoritarians or totalitarians, all in the book, folks. Now, I want to ask a couple of specific things. Ginger and I think we've had COVID. We didn't show up, and our doctors do. Ginger lost her sense of smell. We both were the sickest we've ever been in our lives. And we both had horrible dry coughs, and Ginger lost sense of smell before we knew that was anything to do with COVID. Taste and smell has been gradually coming back to her. We tested negative on some sort of a antibody. Does that prove anything? Is there a better test that people who think they've had COVID-19 can get?
Yeah, I wanted to update the listeners. There are dozens and dozens of antibody tests, and they all have different thresholds for positivity. So don't trust a single antibody test. I had COVID myself, and I tested negative with the Quest Labs antibody three times. And then I had it tested with the Ortho Clinical Diagnostics assay, and I was positive. And just a little tip, they're using, I think, the more sensitive assay when you donate blood. So I got the Ortho Clinical Diagnostics when I went to a church blood drive and I donated blood, and I was thrilled to find that I had positive antibodies. But there are at least a dozen or more of these antibody assays, and they're variable, and they're not trustable, meaning everybody has a sharp rise in the antibodies and then they trail off. What's far more trustable is the T cell immunity.
Yeah.
The FDA has cleared the T cell immunity. I want to explain this to the audience. The test is called T cell direct, and it's by a company called Adaptive Technologies. And what you do
Ginger's already got it.
Yeah, right. What you do is you go online, you fill out the form, and you explain that you've had COVID, you pay your money, and then a medical director at the company looks at it, approves it, and then you get a requisition number, and you go to LabCorp. You go to any LabCorp blood drawing office in your town, and they'll draw two samples of blood. I did it myself, so I know. And they know exactly what to do. It's in the computer. And then you'll get your result back in a week. Yeah. But let me explain how this test works.
We have like 30 seconds left and we're going to run over.
Okay.
This has been amazing. I'll say in brief,
the T-cell direct test is absolutely the best test. It's a permanent test if you've been touched with the virus. I'll let that be the last word.
That is the last word. I lost track of time, but we will finish on time. So there'll be no cutting necessary. Oh, my God. Peter A. McCullough. What a treasure. You're a world treasure, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you for being my friend. Oh, my God. Thank you for writing an introduction to my book. And we will continue to work together in every way we can. And I hope you, those of you who listen today, realize the level of information you're getting from Dr. McCullough today. Thank you, my wonderful audience. Thank you for taking seriously this difficult information. Thank you.